the federal government. Out of such organizations grew the Middle East Studies Association, the powerful support of the Ford and other foundations, the various federal programs of support to universities, the various federal research projects carried out by such entities as the Defense Department, the RAND Corporation, and the Hudson Institute, and the consultative and lobbying efforts of banks, oil companies, multinationals, and the like. It is no reduction to say of all this that it retains, in most of its general as well as its detailed functioning, the traditional Orientalist outlook which had been developed in Europe. The parallel between European and American imperial designs on the Orient, near and far, is obvious. What is perhaps less obvious is, A, the extent to which the European tradition of Orientalist scholarship was, if not taken over, then accommodated, normalized, domesticated, and popularized and fed into the post-war efflorescence of Near Eastern studies in the United States, and B, the extent to which the European tradition has given rise in the United States to a coherent attitude among most scholars, institutions, styles of discourse, and orientations, despite the contemporary appearance of refinement, as well as the use of, again, highly sophisticated appearing social science techniques. I have already discussed Gibbs' ideas. It needs to be pointed out, however, that in the middle 1950s he became director of the Harvard Center for Middle East Studies, from which position his ideas and style exerted an important influence. Gibbs' presence in the United States was different in what it did for the field from Philip Hitti's presence at Princeton since the late 1920s. The Princeton department produced a large group of important scholars, and its brand of Oriental studies stimulated great scholarly interest in the field. Gibb, on the other hand, was more truly in touch with the public policy aspect of Orientalism, and far more than Hitti's at Princeton, his position at Harvard focused Orientalism on a Cold War area studies approach. Gibb's own work, nevertheless, did not overtly employ the language of cultural discourse in the tradition of Renan, Becke, and Massignon. Yet this discourse, its intellectual apparatus, and its dogmas were impressively present, principally, although not exclusively, in the work and institutional authority at Chicago and then at UCLA of Gustav von Grunebaum. He came to the United States as part of the intellectual immigration of European scholars fleeing fascism. Thereafter, he produced a solid Orientalist oeuvre that concentrated on Islam as a holistic culture, about which, from beginning to end of his career, he continued to make the same set of essentially reductive, negative generalizations. His style, which bore often chaotic evidence of his Austro-Germanic polymathy, of his absorption of the canonical pseudo-scientific prejudices of French, British, and Italian Orientalism, as well as of an almost desperate effort to remain the impartial scholar-observer, was next to unreadable. A typical page of his on the Islamic self-image will jam together half a dozen references to Islamic texts drawn from as many periods as possible, references as well to Husserl and the pre-Socratics, references to Levi-Strauss and various American social scientists. All this, nevertheless, does not obscure von Grunebaum's almost virulent dislike of Islam. He has no difficulty presuming that Islam is a unitary phenomenon, unlike any other religion or civilization, and thereafter he shows it to be anti-human, incapable of development, self-knowledge, or objectivity, as well as uncreative, unscientific, and authoritarian. Here are two typical excerpts, and we must remember that von Grunebaum wrote with the unique authority of a European scholar in the United States, teaching, administering, giving grants to a large network of scholars in the field. It is essential to realize that Muslim civilization is a cultural entity that does not share our primary aspirations. It is not vitally interested in the structured study of other cultures, either as an end in itself or as a means toward clearer understanding of its own character and history. If this observation were to be valid merely for contemporary Islam, one might be inclined to connect it with the profoundly disturbed state of Islam, which does not permit it to look beyond itself unless forced to do so. But as it is valid for the past as well, one may perhaps seek to connect it with the basic anti-humanism of this Islamic civilization, that is, the determined refusal to accept man to any extent whatever as the arbiter or the measure of things, and the tendency to be satisfied with the truth as the description of mental structures, or, in other words, with psychological truth. Arab or Islamic nationalism lacks, in spite of its occasional use as a catchword, the concept of the divine right of a nation. It lacks a formative ethic. It also lacks, it would seem, the later 19th century belief in mechanistic progress. Above all, it lacks the intellectual vigor of a primary phenomenon. Both power and the will to power are ends in themselves. This sentence seems to serve no purpose in the argument, yet it doubtless gives von Grunebaum the security of a philosophical-sounding non-sentence, as if to assure himself that he speaks wisely, not disparagingly, of Islam. The resentment of political slights felt by Islam engenders impatience and impedes long-range analysis and planning in the intellectual sphere. In most other contexts, such writing would politely be called polemical. For Orientalism, of course, it is relatively orthodox, and it passed for canonical wisdom in American study of the Middle East after World War II, mainly because of the cultural prestige associated with European scholars. The point is, however, that von Grunebaum's work is accepted uncritically by the field, even though the field itself today cannot reproduce people like him. Yet only one scholar has undertaken a serious critique of von Grunebaum's views, Abdallah Laroui, a Moroccan historian and political theorist. Using the motif of reductive repetition in von Grunebaum's work as a practical tool of critical anti-Orientalist study, Laroui manages his case impressively on the whole. He asks himself what it is that caused von Grunebaum's work, despite the enormous mass of its detail and its apparent range, to remain reductive. As Laroui says, the adjectives that von Grunebaum affixes to the word Islam, medieval, classical, modern, are neutral or even superfluous. There is no difference between classical Islam and medieval Islam or Islam plain and simple. There is, therefore, for von Grunebaum, only one Islam that changes within itself. Modern Islam, according to von Grunebaum, has turned away from the West because it remains faithful to its original sense of itself, and yet Islam can modernize itself only by a self-reinterpretation from a Western point of view, which, of course, von Grunebaum shows is impossible. In describing von Grunebaum's conclusions, which add up to a portrait of Islam as a culture incapable of innovation, Laroui does not mention that the need for Islam to use Western methods to improve itself has, as an idea, perhaps because of von Grunebaum's wide influence, become almost a truism in Middle Eastern studies. For example, David Gordon, in Self-Determination and History in the Third World, urges maturity on Arabs, Africans, and Asians. He argues that this can be gained only by learning from Western objectivity. Laroui's analysis shows also how von Grunebaum employed A.L. Kroeber's culturalist theory to understand Islam, and how this tool necessarily entailed a series of reductions and eliminations by which Islam could be represented as a closed system of exclusions. Thus, each of the many diverse aspects of Islamic culture could be seen by von Grunebaum as a direct reflection of an unvarying matrix, a particular theory of God that compels them all into meaning and order, development, history, tradition, reality in Islam are therefore interchangeable. Larui rightly maintains that history as a complex order of events, temporalities, and meanings cannot be reduced to such a notion of culture, in the same way that culture cannot be reduced to ideology, nor ideology to theology. Von Grunebaum has fallen prey both to the Orientalist dogmas he inherited and to a particular feature of Islam which he has chosen to interpret as a shortcoming. That there is to be found in Islam a highly articulated theory of religion and yet very few accounts of religious experience, highly articulate political theory and few precise political documents, a theory of social structure and very few individualized actions, a theory of history and very few dated events, an articulated theory of economics and very few quantified series, and so on. The net result is a historical vision of Islam entirely hobbled by the theory of a culture incapable of doing justice to or even examining its existential reality in the experience of its adherents. Von Grunebaum's Islam, after all, is the Islam of the earlier European Orientalists, monolithic, scornful of ordinary human experience, gross, reductive, unchanging. At bottom, such a view of Islam is political, not even euphemistically impartial. The strength of its hold on the new Orientalist, younger, that is, than von Grunebaum, is due in part to its traditional authority, and in part to its use value as a handle for grasping a vast region of the world and proclaiming it an entirely coherent phenomenon. Since Islam has never easily been encompassed by the West politically, and certainly since World War II, Arab nationalism has been a movement openly declaring its hostility to Western imperialism, the desire to assert intellectually satisfying things about Islam in retaliation increases. One authority has said of Islam, without specifying which Islam or aspect of Islam he means, that it is one prototype of closed traditional societies. Note here the edifying use of the word Islam to signify all at once a society, a religion, a prototype, and an actuality. But all this will be subordinated by the same scholar to the notion that, unlike normal, our societies, Islam and Middle Eastern societies are totally political, an adjective meant as a reproach to Islam for not being liberal, for not being able to separate, as we do, politics from culture. The result is an invidiously ideological portrait of us and them. To understand Middle Eastern society as a whole must remain our great aim. Only a society, like ours, that has already achieved a dynamic stability can afford to think of politics, economics, or culture as genuinely autonomous realms of existence and not merely convenient divisions for study. In a traditional society that does not separate the things of Caesar from those of God, or that is entirely in flux, the connection between, say, politics and all other aspects of life is the heart of the issue. Today, for example, whether a man is to marry four wives or one, fast or eat, gain or lose land, rely on revelation or reason, have all become political issues in the Middle East. No less than the Muslim himself, the new Orientalist must inquire anew what the significant structures and relationships of Islamic society may be. The triviality of most of the examples, marrying four wives, fasting or eating, etc., is meant as evidence of Islam's all-inclusiveness and its tyranny. As to where this is supposed to be happening, we are not told, but we are reminded of the doubtless non-political fact that Orientalists are largely responsible for having given Middle Easterners themselves an accurate appreciation of their past, just in case we might forget that Orientalists know things by definition that Orientals cannot know on their own. If this sums up the hard school of the new American Orientalism, the soft school emphasizes the fact that traditional Orientalists have given us the basic outlines of Islamic history, religion, and society, but have been all too often content to sum up the meaning of a civilization on the basis of a few manuscripts. Against the traditional Orientalist, therefore, the New Area Studies specialist argues philosophically, research methodology and disciplinary paradigms are not to determine what is selected for study, and they are not to limit observation. Area studies, from this perspective, hold that true knowledge is only possible of things that exist, while methods and theories are abstractions, which order observations and offer explanations according to non-empirical criteria. Good. But how does one know the things that exist, and to what extent are the things that exist constituted by the knower? This is left moot, as the new value-free apprehension of the Orient as something that exists is institutionalized in area studies programs. Without tendentious theorizing, Islam is rarely studied, rarely researched, rarely known. The naivete of this conception scarcely conceals what ideologically it means, the absurd thesis that man plays no part in setting up both the material and the processes of knowledge, that the Oriental reality is static and exists, that only a messianic revolutionary, in Dr. Kissinger's vocabulary, will not admit the difference between reality out there and in his head. Between the hard and soft schools, however, more or less diluted versions of the old Orientalism flourish, in the new academic jargons in some cases, in the old ones in others. But the principal dogmas of Orientalism exist in their purest form today in studies of the Arabs and Islam. Let us recapitulate them here. One is the absolute and systematic difference between the West, which is rational, developed, humane, superior, and the Orient, which is aberrant, undeveloped, inferior. Another dogma is that abstractions about the Orient, particularly those based on texts representing a classical Oriental civilization, are always preferable to direct evidence drawn from modern Oriental realities. A third dogma is that the Orient is eternal, uniform, and incapable of defining itself. Therefore, it is assumed that a highly generalized and systematic vocabulary for describing the Orient from a Western standpoint is inevitable, and even scientifically objective. A fourth dogma is that the Orient is at bottom, something either to be feared, the yellow peril, the Mongol hordes, the brown dominions, or to be controlled by pacification, research and development, outright occupation whenever possible. The extraordinary thing is that these notions persist without significant challenge in the academic and governmental study of the modern Near Orient. Lamentably, there has been no demonstrable effect, if there has been a challenging gesture at all, made by Islamic or Arab scholars' work disputing the dogmas of Orientalism. An isolated article here or there, while important for its time and place, cannot possibly affect the course of an imposing research consensus maintained by all sorts of agencies, institutions, and traditions. The point of this is that Islamic Orientalism has led a contemporary life quite different from that of the other Orientalist sub-disciplines. The Committee of Concerned Asia Scholars, who are primarily Americans, led a revolution during the 1960s in the ranks of East Asia specialists. The African studies specialists were similarly challenged by revisionists. So too were other Third World area specialists. Only the Arabists and Islamologists still function unrevised. For them, there are still such things as an Islamic society, an Arab mind, an Oriental psyche. Even the ones whose specialty is the modern Islamic world anachronistically use texts like the Quran to read into every facet of contemporary Egyptian or Algerian society. Islam, or a 7th-century ideal of it constituted by the Orientalist, is assumed to possess the unity that eludes the more recent and important influences of colonialism, imperialism, and even ordinary politics. Clichés about how Muslims, or Mohammedans as they are still sometimes called, behave, are bandied about with a nonchalance no one would risk in talking about blacks or Jews. At best, the Muslim is a native informant for the Orientalist. Secretly, however, he remains a despised heretic who, for his sins, must additionally endure the entirely thankless position of being known, negatively, that is, as an anti-Zionist. There is, of course, a Middle East studies establishment, a pool of interests, old boy or expert networks linking corporate business, the foundations, the oil companies, the missions, the military, the foreign service, the intelligence community, together with the academic world. There are grants and other rewards. There are organizations. There are hierarchies. There are institutes, centers, faculties, departments, all devoted to legitimizing and maintaining the authority of a handful of basic, basically unchanging ideas about Islam, the Orient, and the Arabs. A recent critical analysis of the Middle East studies operation in the United States shows not that the field is monolithic, but that it is complex, that it contains old-style Orientalists, deliberately marginal specialists, counterinsurgency specialists, policymakers, as well as a small minority of academic power brokers. In any event, the core of Orientalist dogma persists. As an instance of what, in its highest and most intellectually prestigious form, the field now produces, let us consider briefly the 2-volume Cambridge History of Islam, which was first published in England in 1970 and is a regular summa of Orientalist orthodoxy. To say of this work by numerous luminaries that it is an intellectual failure by any standards other than those of Orientalism is to say that it could have been a different and better history of Islam. In fact, as several more thoughtful scholars have noted, this kind of history was already doomed when first planned and could not have been different or better in execution. Too many ideas were uncritically accepted by its editors. There was too much reliance on vague concepts. Little emphasis was placed on methodological issues, which were left as they have been standing in Orientalist discourse for almost 2 centuries. And no effort was put forth to make even the idea of Islam seem interesting. Moreover, not only does the Cambridge History of Islam radically misconceive and misrepresent Islam as a religion, it also has no corporate idea of itself as a history. Of few such enormous enterprises can it be true, as it is of this one, that ideas and methodological intelligence are almost entirely absent from it. Irfan Shahid's chapter on pre-Islamic Arabia, which opens the history, intelligently sketches the fruitful consonance between topography and human economy out of which Islam appeared in the 7th century. But what can one fairly say of a history of Islam, defined by P.M. Holt's introduction rather airily as a cultural synthesis that proceeds directly from pre-Islamic Arabia to a chapter on Muhammad, then to a chapter on the patriarchal and Umayyad caliphates, and entirely bypasses any account of Islam as a system of belief, faith, or doctrine? For hundreds of pages in Volume 1, Islam is understood to mean an unrelieved chronology of battles, reigns, and deaths rises and heydays, comings and passings, written for the most part in a ghastly monotone. Take the Abbasid period from the 8th to the 11th century as an instance. Anyone who has the slightest acquaintance with Arab or Islamic history will know that it was a high point of Islamic civilization, as brilliant a period of cultural history as the High Renaissance in Italy. Yet nowhere in the 40 pages of description does one get an inkling of any richness. What is found instead is sentences like this. Once master of the caliphate, Al-Ma'mun seemed henceforth to shrink from contact with Baghdad society and remained settled at Merv, entrusting the government of Iraq to one of his trusted men, Al-Hasan ibn Sahl, the brother of Al-Fadl, who was faced almost at once with a serious Shi'i revolt, that of Abul Saraya, who in Jumada 2-199, January 815, sent out a call to arms from Kufa in support of the Hassanid ibn Tabataba. A non-Islamicist will not know at this point what a Shi'i or a Hassanid is. He will have no idea what Jumada 2 is, except that it clearly designates a date of some sort, and of course he will believe that the Abbasids, including Harun al-Rashid, were an incorrigibly dull and murderous lot as they sat sulking in Merv. The central Islamic lands are defined as excluding North Africa and Andalusia, and their history is an orderly march from the past till modern times. In Volume 1, therefore, Islam is a geographical designation, applied chronologically and selectively as it suits the experts. But nowhere in the chapters on classical Islam is there an adequate preparation for the disappointments in store for us when we come to recent times, as they are called. The chapter on the modern Arab lands is written without the slightest understanding of the revolutionary developments in the area. The author takes a schoolmarmish, openly reactionary attitude towards the Arabs. It must be said that during this period the educated and uneducated youth of the Arab countries, with their enthusiasm and idealism, became a fertile soil for political exploitation and, at times, perhaps without realizing it, the tools of unscrupulous extremists and agitators. Tempered by occasional praise of Lebanese nationalism, although we are never told that the appeal of fascism to a small number of Arabs during the 30s also infected the Lebanese Maronites, who in 1936 founded the Falange Libanaise as a copy of Mussolini's Black Shirts. Unrest and agitation are ascribed to 1936 without a mention of Zionism, and the very notions of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism are never allowed to violate the serenity of the narrative. As for the chapters on the political impact of the West and economic and social change, ideas left no more specific than that. They are tacked on as reluctant concessions to Islam as having something to do with our world in general. Change is unilaterally equated with modernization, even though it is nowhere made clear why other kinds of change need be so imperiously dismissed, since it is assumed that Islam's only worthwhile relations have been with the West, the importance of Bandung, or of Africa, or of the Third World generally, is ignored. This blithe indifference to a good three-quarters of reality somewhat explains the amazingly cheerful statement that the historical ground has been cleared. By whom? For what? In what way? For a new relationship between the West and Islam, based on equality and cooperation. If by the end of Volume 1 we are mired in a number of contradictions and difficulties about what Islam really is, there is no help to be had in Volume 2. Half the book is devoted to covering the 10th to the 20th centuries in India, Pakistan, Indonesia, Spain, North Africa, and Sicily. There is more distinction in the chapters on North Africa, although the same combination of professional Orientalist jargon with unguided historical detail prevails pretty much everywhere. So far, after approximately 1,200 pages of dense prose, Islam appears to be no more a cultural synthesis than any other roll call of kings, battles, and dynasties. But in the last half of Volume 2, the great synthesis completes itself with articles on the geographical setting, sources of Islamic civilization, religion and culture, and warfare. Now one's legitimate questions and objections seem more justified. Why is a chapter commissioned on Islamic warfare when what is really discussed, interestingly, by the way, is the sociology of some Islamic armies? Is one to assume that there is an Islamic mode of war different, say, from Christian warfare? Communist war versus capitalist war proposes itself as a suitably analogous topic. Of what use for the understanding of Islam, except as a display of Gustav von Grunebaum's indiscriminate erudition, are the opaque quotations from Leopold von Ranke, which, along with other equally ponderous and irrelevant material, dot his pages on Islamic civilization? Is it not mendacious thus to disguise the real Grunebaumian thesis that Islamic civilization rests on an unprincipled borrowing by Muslims from the Judeo-Christian, Hellenistic, and Austro-Germanic civilizations? Compare with this idea that Islam is by definition a plagiaristic culture, the one put forward in Volume 1, that so-called Arabic literature was written by Persians. No proof offered, no names cited. When Louis Gardet treats religion and culture, we are told summarily that only the first 5 centuries of Islam are to be discussed. Does this mean that religion and culture in modern times cannot be synthesized, or does it mean that Islam achieved its final form in the 12th century? Is there really such a thing as Islamic geography, which seems to include the planned anarchy of Muslim cities, or is it mainly an invented subject to demonstrate a rigid theory of geographical racial determinism? As a hint, we are reminded of the Ramadan fast with its active nights, from which we are expected to conclude that Islam is a religion designed for town dwellers. This is explanation in need of explanation. The sections on economic and social institutions, on law and justice, mysticism, art and architecture, science, and the various Islamic literatures are on an altogether higher level than most of the history. Yet nowhere is there evidence that their authors have much in common with modern humanists or social scientists in other disciplines, the techniques of the conventional history of ideas, of Marxist analysis, of the new history, are noticeably absent. Islam, in short, seems to its historians to be best suited to a rather Platonic and antiquarian bias. To some writers of the history, Islam is a politics and a religion. To others, it is a style of being. To others, it is distinguishable from Muslim society. To still others, it is a mysteriously known essence. To all the authors, Islam is a remote, tensionless thing, without much to teach us about the complexities of today's Muslims. Hanging over the whole disjointed enterprise which is the Cambridge history of Islam is the old Orientalist truism that Islam is about texts, not about people. The fundamental question raised by such contemporary Orientalist texts as the Cambridge history is whether ethnic origins and religion are the best, or at least the most useful, basic and clear definitions of human experience. Does it matter more in understanding contemporary politics to know that X and Y are disadvantaged in certain very concrete ways, or that they are Muslims or Jews? This is, of course, a debatable question, and we are very likely in rational terms to insist on both the religious ethnic and the socio-economic descriptions. Orientalism, however, clearly posits the Islamic category as the dominant one, and this is the main consideration about its retrograde intellectual tactics. 3. Merely Islam. So deeply entrenched is the theory of Semitic simplicity as it is to be found in modern Orientalism that it operates with little differentiation in such well-known anti-Semitic European writings as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and in remarks such as these by Chaim Weizmann to Arthur Balfour on May 30, 1918. The Arabs, who are superficially clever and quick-witted, worship one thing and one thing only, power and success. The British authorities, knowing as they do the treacherous nature of the Arabs, have to watch carefully and constantly. The fairer the English regime tries to be, the more arrogant the Arab becomes. The present state of affairs would necessarily tend toward the creation of an Arab Palestine, if there were an Arab people in Palestine. It will not, in fact, produce that result because the Fellah is at least 4 centuries behind the times, and the Effendi is dishonest, uneducated, greedy, and as unpatriotic as he is inefficient. The common denominator between Weizmann and the European anti-Semite is the Orientalist perspective, seeing Semites, or subdivisions thereof, as by nature lacking the desirable qualities of Occidentals. Yet the difference between Renan and Weizmann is that the latter had already gathered behind his rhetoric the solidity of institutions, whereas the former had not. Is there not in 20th century Orientalism that same unaging, gracious childhood, heedlessly allied now with scholarship, now with a state and all its institutions, that Renan saw as the Semites' unchanging mode of being? Yet with what greater harm has the 20th century version of the myth been maintained? It has produced a picture of the Arab as seen by an advanced, quasi-Occidental society. In his resistance to foreign colonialists, the Palestinian was either a stupid savage or a negligible quantity, morally and even existentially. According to Israeli law, only a Jew has full civic rights and unqualified immigration privileges. Even though they are the land's inhabitants, Arabs are given less, more simple rights. They cannot immigrate, and if they seem not to have the same rights, it is because they are less developed. Orientalism governs Israeli policy towards the Arabs throughout, as the recently published Koenig report amply proves. There are good Arabs, the ones who do as they are told, and bad Arabs, who do not, and are therefore terrorists. Most of all, there are all those Arabs who, once defeated, can be expected to sit obediently behind an infallibly fortified line, manned by the smallest possible number of men, on the theory that Arabs have had to accept the myth of Israeli superiority and will never dare attack. One need only glance through the pages of General Yehoshaphat Harkabi's Arab Attitudes to Israel to see how, as Robert Alter put it in admiring language in commentary, the Arab mind, depraved, anti-Semitic to the core, violent, unbalanced, could produce only rhetoric and little more. One myth supports and produces another. They answer each other, tending towards symmetries and patterns of the sort that, as Orientals, the Arabs themselves can be expected to produce, but that, as a human being, no Arab can truly sustain. Of itself, in itself, as a set of beliefs, as a method of analysis, Orientalism cannot develop. Indeed, it is the doctrinal antithesis of development. Its central argument is the myth of the arrested development of the Semites. From this matrix, other myths pour forth, each of them showing the Semite to be the opposite of the Westerner, and irremediably the victim of his own weaknesses. By a concatenation of events and circumstances, the Semitic myth bifurcated in the Zionist movement. One Semite went the way of Orientalism, the other, the Arab, was forced to go the way of the Oriental. Each time tent and tribe are solicited, the myth is being employed. Each time the concept of Arab national character is evoked, the myth is being employed. The hold these instruments have on the mind is increased by the institutions built around them. For every Orientalist, quite literally, there is a support system of staggering power, considering the ephemerality of the myths that Orientalism propagates. This system now culminates in the very institutions of the state. To write about the Arab Oriental world, therefore, is to write with the authority of a nation, and not with the affirmation of a strident ideology, but with the unquestioning certainty of absolute truth backed by absolute force. In its February 1974 issue, Commentary gave its readers an article by Professor Gil Carl Alroy entitled, "Do the Arabs Want Peace?" Alroy is a professor of political science and is the author of two works, Attitudes Towards Jewish Statehood in the Arab World and Images of Middle East Conflict. He is a man who professes to know the Arabs and is obviously an expert on image making. His argument is quite predictable, that the Arabs want to destroy Israel, that the Arabs really say what they mean, and Alroy makes ostentatious use of his ability to cite evidence from Egyptian newspapers, evidence he everywhere identifies with Arabs, as if the two, Arabs and Egyptian newspapers, were one, and so on and on, with unflagging one-eyed zeal. Quite the center of his article, as it is the center of previous work by other Arabists, synonymous with Orientalists, like General Harkabi, whose province is the Arab mind, is a working hypothesis on what Arabs, if one peels off all the outer nonsense, are really like. In other words, Alroy must prove that because Arabs are, first of all, as one in their bent for bloody vengeance, second, psychologically incapable of peace, and third, congenitally tied to a concept of justice that means the opposite of that, they are not to be trusted and must be fought interminably as one fights any other fatal disease. For evidence, Alroy's principal exhibit is a quotation taken from Harold W. Glidden's essay, The Arab World, to which I referred in Chapter 1. Alroy finds Glidden able to have captured the cultural differences between the Western and the Arab view of things very well. Alroy's argument is clinched, therefore. The Arabs are unregenerate savages, and thus an authority on the Arab mind has told a wide audience of presumably concerned Jews that they must continue to watch out, and he has done it academically, dispassionately, fairly, using evidence taken from the Arabs themselves, who, he says with Olympian assurance, have emphatically ruled out real peace, and from psychoanalysis. One can explain such statements by recognizing that a still more implicit and powerful difference posited by the Orientalist as against the Oriental is that the former writes about, whereas the latter is written about. For the latter, passivity is the presumed role. For the former, the power to observe, study, and so forth. As Roland Barthes has said, a myth and its perpetuators can invent itself, themselves, ceaselessly. The Oriental is given as fixed, stable, in need of investigation, in need even of knowledge about himself. No dialectic is either desired or allowed. There is a source of information, the Oriental, and a source of knowledge, the Orientalist. In short, a writer and a subject matter otherwise inert. The relationship between the two is radically a matter of power, for which there are numerous images. Here is an instance taken from Raphael Patai's Golden River to Golden Road. In order properly to evaluate what Middle Eastern culture will willingly accept from the embarrassingly rich storehouses of Western civilization, a better and sounder understanding of Middle Eastern culture must first be acquired. The same prerequisite is necessary in order to gauge the probable effects of newly introduced traits on the cultural context of tradition-directed peoples. Also, the ways and means in which new cultural offerings can be made palatable must be studied much more thoroughly than was hitherto the case. In brief, the only way in which the Gordian knot of resistance to Westernization in the Middle East can be unraveled is that of studying the Middle East, of obtaining a fuller picture of its traditional culture, a better understanding of the processes of change taking place in it at present, and a deeper insight into the psychology of human groups brought up in Middle Eastern culture. The task is taxing, but the prize, harmony between the West and a neighboring world area of crucial importance, is well worth it. The metaphorical figures propping up this passage come from a variety of human activities, some commercial, some horticultural, some religious, some veterinary, some historical. Yet in each case, the relation between the Middle East and the West is really defined as sexual. As I said earlier in discussing Flaubert, the association between the Orient and sex is remarkably persistent. The Middle East is resistant, as any virgin would be, but the male scholar wins the prize by bursting open, penetrating through the Gordian knot despite the taxing task. Harmony is the result of the conquest of maidenly coyness. It is not, by any means, the coexistence of equals. The underlying power relation between scholar and subject matter is never once altered. It is uniformly favorable to the Orientalist. Study, understanding, knowledge, evaluation, masked as blandishments to harmony, are instruments of conquest. The verbal operations in such writing as Patai's, who has outstripped even his previous work in his recent The Arab Mind, aim at a very particular sort of compression and reduction. Much of his paraphernalia is anthropological. He describes the Middle East as a culture area, but the result is to eradicate the plurality of differences among the Arabs, whoever they may be, in fact, in the interest of one difference, that one setting Arabs off from everyone else. As a subject matter for study and analysis, they can be controlled more readily. Moreover, thus reduced, they can be made to permit, legitimate, and valorize general nonsense of the sort one finds in works such as Sanya Hamadi's Temperament and Character of the Arabs. Item. The Arabs, so far, have demonstrated an incapacity for disciplined and abiding unity. They experience collective outbursts of enthusiasm, but do not pursue patiently collective endeavors, which are usually embraced half-heartedly. They show lack of coordination and harmony in organization and function, nor have they revealed an ability for cooperation. Any collective action for common benefit or mutual profit is alien to them. The style of this prose tells more, perhaps, than Hamadi intends. Verbs like demonstrate, reveal, show are used without an indirect object. To whom are the Arabs revealing, demonstrating, showing? To no one in particular, obviously, but to everyone in general. This is another way of saying that these truths are self-evident only to a privileged or initiated observer, since nowhere does Hamadi cite generally available evidence for her observations. Besides, given the inanity of the observations, what sort of evidence could there be? As her prose moves along, her tone increases in confidence. Any collective action is alien to them. The categories harden. The assertions are more unyielding, and the Arabs have been totally transformed from people into no more than the putative subject of Hamadi's style. The Arabs exist only as an occasion for the tyrannical observer. The world is my idea. And so it is throughout the work of the contemporary Orientalist. Assertions of the most bizarre sort dot his or her pages, whether it is a Manfred Halpern arguing that even though all human thought processes can be reduced to 8, the Islamic mind is capable of only 4. Or a Mauro Berger presuming that since the Arabic language is much given to rhetoric, Arabs are consequently incapable of true thought. One can call these assertions myths in their function and structure, and yet one must try to understand what other imperatives govern their use. Here one is speculating, of course. Orientalist generalizations about the Arabs are very detailed when it comes to itemizing Arab characteristics critically, far less so when it comes to analyzing Arab strengths. The Arab family, Arab rhetoric, the Arab character, despite copious descriptions by the Orientalist, appear denatured, without human potency, even as these same descriptions possess a fullness and depth in their sweeping power over the subject matter. Hammadi again. Thus, the Arab lives in a hard and frustrating environment. He has little chance to develop his potentialities and define his position in society, holds little belief in progress and change, and finds salvation only in the hereafter. What the Arab cannot achieve himself is to be found in the writing about him. The Orientalist is supremely certain of his potential, is not a pessimist, is able to define his position, his own, and the Arab's. The picture of the Arab Oriental that emerges is determinedly negative. Yet, we ask, why this endless series of works on him? What grips the Orientalist, if it is not, as it certainly is not, love of Arab science, mind, society, achievement? In other words, what is the nature of Arab presence in mythic discourse about him? Two things, number and generative power. Both qualities are reducible to each other ultimately, but we ought to separate them for the purposes of analysis. Almost without exception, every contemporary work of Orientalist scholarship, especially in the social sciences, has a great deal to say about the family, its male-dominated structure, its all-pervasive influence in the society. Patai's work is a typical example. A silent paradox immediately presents itself, for if the family is an institution for whose general failures the only remedy is the placebo of modernization, we must acknowledge that the family continues to produce itself, is fertile, and is the source of Arab existence in the world such as it is. What Berger refers to as the great value men place upon their own sexual prowess suggests the lurking power behind Arab presence in the world. If Arab society is represented in almost completely negative and generally passive terms, to be ravished and won by the Orientalist hero, we can assume that such a representation is a way of dealing with the great variety and potency of Arab diversity, whose source is, if not intellectual and social, then sexual and biological. Yet the absolutely inviolable taboo in Orientalist discourse is that very sexuality must never be taken seriously. It can never be explicitly blamed for the absence of achievement and real rational sophistication the Orientalist everywhere discovers among the Arabs. And yet this is, I think, the missing link in arguments whose main object is criticism of traditional Arab society, such as Hammadi's, Berger's, and Lerner's. They recognize the power of the family, note the weaknesses of the Arab mind, remark the importance of the Oriental world to the West, but never say what their discourse implies, that what is really left to the Arab after all is said and done is an undifferentiated sexual drive. On rare occasions, as in the work of Léon Mounieri, we do find the implicit made clear, that there is a powerful sexual appetite, characteristic of those hot-blooded Southerners. Most of the time, however, the belittlement of Arab society and its reduction of platitudes inconceivable for any except the racially inferior are carried on over an undercurrent of sexual exaggeration. The Arab produces himself endlessly, sexually, and little else. The Orientalist says nothing about this, although his argument depends on it. But cooperation in the Near East is still largely a family affair, and little of it is found outside the blood group or village. Which is to say that the only way in which Arabs count is as mere biological beings. Institutionally, politically, culturally, they are nil, or next to nil. Numerically, and as the producers of families, Arabs are actual. The difficulty with this view is that it complicates the passivity amongst Arabs assumed by Orientalists like Patai and even Hammadi and the others. But it is in the logic of myths, like dreams, exactly to welcome radical antitheses. For a myth does not analyze or solve problems. It represents them as already analyzed and solved. That is, it presents them as already assembled images, in the way a scarecrow is assembled from bric-a-brac and then made to stand for a man. Since the image uses all material to its own end, and since by definition the myth displaces life, the antithesis between an over-fertile Arab and a passive doll is not functional. The discourse papers over the antithesis. An Arab Oriental is that impossible creature whose libidinal energy drives him to paroxysms of overstimulation, and yet he is as a puppet in the eyes of the world, staring vacantly out at a modern landscape he can neither understand nor cope with. It is in recent discussions of Oriental political behavior that such an image of the Arab seems to be relevant, and it is often occasioned by scholarly discussion of those two recent favorites of Orientalist expertise, revolution and modernization. Under the auspices of the School of Oriental and African Studies, there appeared in 1972 a volume entitled Revolution in the Middle East and Other Case Studies, edited by P.J. Vatikiotis. The title is overtly medical, for we are expected to think of Orientalists as finally being given the benefit of what traditional Orientalism usually avoided, psychoclinical attention. Vatikiotis sets the tone of the collection with a quasi-medical definition of revolution. But since Arab revolution is in his mind and in his readers, the hostility of the definition seems acceptable. There is a very clever irony here about which I shall speak later. Vatikiotis's theoretical support is Camus, whose colonial mentality was no friend of revolution or of the Arabs, as Connor Cruz O'Brien has recently shown. But the phrase, revolution destroys both men and principles, is accepted from Camus as having fundamental sense. Vatikiotis continues. All revolutionary ideology is in direct conflict with, actually is a head-on attack upon, man's rational, biological, and psychological makeup. Committed as it is to a methodical metastasis, revolutionary ideology demands fanaticism from its adherents. Politics for the revolutionary is not only a question of belief, or a substitute for religious belief. It must stop being what it has always been, namely, an adaptive activity in time for survival. Metastatic, soteriological politics abhors adaptiveness, for how else can it eschew the difficulties, ignore and bypass the obstacles of the complex biological, psychological dimension of man, or mesmerize his subtle, though limited and vulnerable rationality? It fears and shuns the concrete and discrete nature of human problems and the preoccupations of political life. It thrives on the abstract and the Promethean. It subordinates all tangible values to the one supreme value, the harnessing of man and history in a grand design of human liberation. It is not satisfied with human politics, which has so many irritating limitations. It wishes instead to create a new world, not adaptively, precariously, delicately, that is, humanly, but by a terrifying act of Olympian pseudo-divine creation. Politics in the service of man is a formula that is unacceptable to the revolutionary ideologue. Rather, man exists to serve a politically contrived and brutally decreed order. Whatever else this passage says, purple writing of the most extreme sort, counter-revolutionary zealotry, it is saying nothing less than that revolution is a bad kind of sexuality, pseudo-divine act of creation, and also a cancerous disease. Whatever is done by the human, according to Vatikiotis, is rational, right, subtle, discreet, concrete. Whatever the revolutionary proclaims is brutal,